Welcome, everyone. Welcome back for those of us who are joining for the third installment of what is going to be at least a year-long series of talks titled Russia and Its Neighbors in Search of a New Paradigm, led by Dr. Yevgenia Albots, who is a research professor in the NYU Department of Russian and Slavic Studies, an investigative journalist, political scientist, author, and radio host. And since getting her PhD in political science from Harvard University, she split her time between academia and journalism. So thank you that she is with us here in academia today. She was a professor of political science at the Higher School of Economics and the first professor fired on the request of the Kremlin. She has been editor-in-chief of the political weekly The New Times since 2007 and a talk show host on Echo Muscovy until the station was taken off the air 5 days after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And her show, Absolute Albats, now continues on her YouTube channel. She was previously the distinguished journalist in residence here at the Jordan Center from 22 to 23. She's also been a media and democracy fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School and a fellow at the Davis Center for the for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard. The title of today's talk is How Dictators Negotiate, Alexander Lukashenko's Role as Intermediary Between the Kremlin and the White House. And we are joined by our esteemed guest, Simon Schuster, who is a staff writer for The Atlantic and has reported on Russia, Ukraine, and other parts of the former Soviet Union for over 17 years. His political coverage of Russia's descent into authoritarianism included numerous profiles of Vladimir Putin and interviews with Dmitry Medvedev and other top Russian officials. This summer, his interview with Alexander Lukashenko exposed a secret back channel between the Kremlin and the White House through Minsk. Simon has also interviewed and profiled the last three presidents of Ukraine, starting with Viktor Yanukovych, whose violent overthrow in 2014 he covered from Independence Square in Kyiv. While reporting on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, he traveled three times with President Zelensky to the front lines of the war and spent months reporting from inside the presidential compound in Kyiv. His best-selling book, The Showman, chronicles the war in Ukraine from the perspective of President Zelensky and his team. So I'd like to welcome Simon Schuster. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you so much, Professor Albots, for leading this wonderful team.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sasha, thank you very much for this lovely introduction, and thank you to the Jordan Center and for the Department of Russian and Slavic Studies for hosting those events. I also want to just to add that Simon was born in Moscow, in Russia, and he graduated from Stanford University. And last year, he published a book about Volodymyr Zelensky. And it's called The Showman, Inside the Invasion That Shook the World and Made a Leader of Vladimir Zelensky. It was published last year. I interviewed Simon about that book. And of course, and so we're going to talk about Ukraine also, because it's just impossible not to, given all the events that are going around as of we speak. But today we're going to talk first and foremost about Belarus and its dictator, Alexander Lukashenko, as Simon Schuster was one of the very few Western journalists to interview the dictator at large after Lukashenko became an intermediary between US President Donald Trump and Russian war criminal Vladimir Putin. And it was very interesting because few people, I think nobody really knew what was going on. It was revealed through that interview. And then, of course, Simon published a big feature story in Time magazine. Back then, he was still at Time magazine, where he just disclosed that apparently the State Department the American State Department has been using Lukashenko as an intermediary for quite some time. It was they just were finding ways how to approach Putin on sort of less formal basis. So I would like, please show the map of Belarus, because before I ask Simon the first question, let me remind you that Belarus is a landlocked country in Eastern Europe with a population of 9.1 million people. It is bordered by gigantic Russia in the east, Ukraine to the south, Poland to the west, and two Baltic nations, Lithuania and Latvia, to the northwest. Alexander Lukashenko is the dictator of Belarus, elected president in July 1994. 1994, the whole generation ago, and has never left office. Belarus is at large a Russian vassal state whose economy, agriculture, and essence heavily depends on Russian oil, which Belarusian plants convert into petrochemicals and sell to Western Europe. It's one of the biggest source of hard currency in Belarus. There are 1,200 political prisoners in Belarus whom Lukashenko trades like slaves in exchange for the benefits from the West. Please, now, I will have a very short video. Just, it's not, you will see for yourself why I chose this video to start this conversation.
In order to give assessments, what really outraged me, I told the press secretary about this once, our well-known kind Jewish woman, Shengel Batz. I watched her. An enemy is an enemy, but sometimes she reasons. If you know her, sometimes she reasons correctly. And then this phrase of hers, oh, Putin slammed Trump's face into the TV. She didn't hold back. She just went for it. And I look at her and think, you're not a stupid woman. She knows how to analyze. A good propagandist, by the way. Look, why are you drawing conclusions without understanding the situation? What did Trump lose to Putin there? They had different roles. The fact that he invited him to Alaska, well, I say a bit exotic, but beautiful. Putin called me before this saying Rome is being discussed, Geneva, Turkey, the Emirates, and so on. I say, well, going to Rome for us Orthodox. Yes, he says, I understand that. Well, they rejected all those vacations, he says. We will wait for what the Americans offer. And the next day, Trump called and said, listen, let's do Alaska. The two presidents agreed, absolutely understanding each other, and met in Alaska. There was no dispute at all. It's fine. I was even surprised. I never thought it would be possible to meet in Alaska to discuss these questions. Everything is simple. There is no need to make a big event out of this. What role did they play, both these two presidents? Well, it's clear. This one was a mediator, and that one is one of the conflicting sides. Why reproach Trump here that he didn't bring back concrete results?
Anyway, so a nice Jewish woman, of course, that's me. And but Lukashenko apparently listened to my op-ed piece on Trump-Putin summit in Alaska, and he disagreed with me. But what is also very interesting that's his presser to the so-called Russian journalists. There are no journalists, obviously, in the dictatorship. So all these people who work with Lukashenko, and he gave a big presser, and basically the main message that Lukashenko delivered during this presser was that first Putin called him and asked him his help to set up a summit with American president, and that there were all kind of suggestions, but of course since they are all Orthodox, meaning Russian Orthodox, Belarusian Orthodox, they couldn't go to Rome. Because, of course, in the 21st century, for an Orthodox to go to Catholic Rome, it's impossible, right? No. Yes. And also that Donald Trump, President of the United States, also called him and asked his help. And apparently, it was Lukashenko who facilitated the summit between, in Anchorage, Alaska. Between Vladimir Putin and President of the United States, Donald Trump. So, Simon, since you know the story from both sides, and from reading your Time magazine piece, I understand that you spoke to a lot of American officials who facilitated this, all these connections through Lukashenko. So, how did it happen that Lukashenko became the mediator between Donald Trump and Putin?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for hosting. It's a great question to start with. Thank you all for being here. And Sasha, thank you for the introduction. It makes me sound very serious.
And I apologize in advance. I'm recovering from a cold, so my voice is a little weak. So if you can't hear me, please speak up. How did it happen? So I think this was happening over the course of this year. So since Donald Trump took office in January or returned to the White House, one of his main campaign promises was to end the war in Ukraine in 24 hours, as you all remember. And there were various channels they were using to try to achieve that. The main one early on and still to this day, you could say, is the Steve Witkoff channel, an old friend of Donald Trump who has been the envoy primarily to the Kremlin, but also to the Middle East and various other places. And the Witkoff channel has been, active in fits and starts throughout the year. But it was, I'd say, in the spring and early summer, clear that it wasn't working. So Witkoff was coming back from Moscow after his repeated trips without much progress on any kind of peace deal. He was hearing detailed lectures from Vladimir Putin about medieval Slavic history, but no kind of concessions or compromises on the Russian side. So there was a team of officials in the State Department and in the White House who began pursuing alternative channels of reaching Putin and trying to get Putin to cooperate or negotiate in good faith to try to end the war. And one of the channels, I'd say the main alternative channel that they pursued was through this gentleman, Lukashenko. They began reaching out to him really early. I mean, so let me say specifically who they are. We're talking about a official in the State Department named Christopher Smith, very experienced diplomat. I'd say one of the few career diplomats who stayed in his position and maintained a good deal of influence after Trump took office and began purging quite a lot of the more kind of experts and professionals and career politicians from the State Department. Chris Smith remained, and he, I would say, is kind of the author of this idea to pursue a back channel to the Kremlin through Belarus. He was conducting these talks initially, and we're talking after the elections, so in November of last year, even before the inauguration of Donald Trump, the second inauguration. Chris Smith at the State Department was very quietly conducting these talks with the Belarusian envoy to the United Nations here in New York. And they were talking about, what can we do? How can we maybe restore relations between the US and Belarus? What can we do about Ukraine? And over time, Chris Smith managed to bring in some officials from the White House who were sympathetic to this idea. Who thought this could be more productive than the Witkoff channel? One of them was Keith Kellogg, a retired general of the US Army who was Trump's envoy to Ukraine. And then a close associate of General Kellogg's, John Cole, who is a former attorney for President Donald Trump. He is the attorney who worked on a class action lawsuit against Facebook and other social media companies that banned Trump from their platforms after the January 6th insurrection. So after that insurrection, many, Twitter, which was then still not owned yet by Elon Musk, Facebook, they banned Trump, and then Trump filed a lawsuit against them. And John Cole's lawyer was representing Trump in those cases. Quite successfully. So it ended in at least in the case of Facebook, quite a big payout to from Facebook settlement. Anyway, so there are these three officials, so John Cole, Keith Kellogg in the White House, Chris Smith in the State Department, who were began working on this idea and seeing what they could do with Lukashenko. Now, from Lukashenko's side, he saw an opportunity when he heard these signals reaching him through his envoy at the United Nations, whose name escapes me at the moment, but anyway, Lukashenko saw this as a good opportunity to do a few things. First and foremost, ease the American sanctions on Belarus that have been very intense since even before the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, in which Belarus was complicit. But starting in 2020, when Lukashenko staged his most recent re-election and put down very violently a popular uprising against him, the most recent one, he's been under very intense sanctions from Europe and the United States. So he wanted to get some of those eased, at least through collaborating with these American officials who were reaching out to him. So again, I want to underscore that this was not Lukashenko's idea. The Americans reached out to him to sort of open this back channel. And then he also discussed this idea with Putin. Putin is his, old friend. They're very close and talk very frequently. Again, they I think are both responsible, maybe not an equal measure, certainly not an equal measure, but both responsible for the invasion of Ukraine. Belarus helped Russia stage that invasion. So he called up Putin, and sort of my understanding of what the proposal was, he said, these Americans are reaching out. They want to pursue some kind of deal or talks on Ukraine. And this seemed appealing to Putin. For a number of reasons, we could talk about them later, but basically he said, well, why not try? Let's see what we can get out of them. Let's see what they can offer. Let's see if we can also use this to ease sanctions on Russia, or at least stop the Americans from imposing new sanctions on Russia related to the war in Ukraine. So Putin also saw this outreach, this back channel, as a kind of opportunity. So then, they began talking more in earnest. I'd say in the spring. US officials, starting with Chris Smith. When was his first visit? I can't remember now. I think it was in February.
Chris Smith went
Chris
to Belarus.
Chris Smith went to Belarus in person. He was the first representative of the Trump administration to go there. One of the first, if not the first, to make an official visit to Belarus since 2020, when the crackdown on the opposition in Belarus happened. So he went there, opened this back channel, then we were off and running. But I guess that's kind of the long answer to your simple question of how we started. So we can take it from
You
there.
know, I'm sorry, I didn't get why did they choose Lukashenko? Why they couldn't, just use Russians in the United Nations or in the embassy to call Putin? What was the point? Besides that, Putin hates Lukashenko. They pretend that they have good relationship, but Putin hates him, and they hate each other because Lukashenko.
Frenemies.
Yes, they're friend enemies because Lukashenko is badly dependable upon Putin, and And Putin knows that Lukashenko is going to betray him in the first minute. He will be weak. So anyway, so why Lukashenko? What was the point of using Lukashenko?
I mean, they couldn't understand at the time. So through the Witkoff channel, and also in public, Putin was saying, I want to pursue a peace deal with the Americans. I want to pursue negotiations. We should end this war and resolve its root causes and all this stuff. But at the same time was not only continuing but intensifying the horrific bombings of civilian areas in Ukraine. So there was this disconnect that the Americans really, and Trump personally, found it very hard to understand. Why is Putin saying one thing and doing the exact opposite? Why won't he allow even like a 2 week pause in these bombings to allow some negotiating process to firm up and begin to proceed? And they were really baffled by this. No one could give them a good answer. So they were asking various people who they felt understood or understand Putin, and Lukashenko was one of them. I mean, they have a very frenemies is a good way to put it. Their relationship is complicated, but if you want a Putin whisperer or someone to explain to you what Putin is like, Lukashenko is a pretty good candidate. So that's who was available to them. So they pursued it for that reason. I think it was largely out of frustration with, what we can call the main channel. The main channel being, Witkoff, the official diplomatic conversations between the U.S. and Russia. So that wasn't working. It was leading to confusion and frustration on Trump's part. So they asked Lukashenko, what does Putin want? This eternal question that my editors have asked me for 20 years. What does Putin want? And they came to this with this question to Lukashenko.
I see. Donald Trump in his Truth Social praised Lukashenko as, quote, a powerful leader and, quote, a highly respected president,
Yes.
unquote. What made the US president so sympathetic to Lukashenko? Moreover, what do you think about Lukashenko after interviewing him in July of 2025? It was late July 2025, right?
Yeah,
Yes,
that's
yes,
right.
yes, yes.
Yeah, that's right. So let me take the first question. So it's important to understand the context in which Trump made that statement. He was flying on his plane to Alaska to meet Putin when he put out this statement, basically thanking Lukashenko for his role in arranging the summit. I had sort of exposed this back channel and Lukashenko's role in it in my article few days before, about a week before. But when Trump sent out that social media post, it was sort of out in the open officially. Trump basically acknowledged that yes, this very respected quote leader of Belarus clearly played an important role. So he was just thanking him for arranging this summit in Anchorage, which at the time, when Trump was flying there, Trump had high hopes that it would be a breakthrough, that it would look very good, it would bring him closer to a Nobel Peace Prize and all kinds of things, that he wants. So he was excited, and his advisors, again, were telling him that Lukashenko was directly involved. I believe he also called Lukashenko. Maybe he called him before. I'm not aware of any direct call, but I believe he called him from the plane,
He did call him, yes.
and thanked him personally. I believe there may have been calls that I'm not aware of before that between Trump personally and Lukashenko. As I understand, before that, they were talking through intermediaries. But that statement was, with Trump on the plane. What was the second? Was the second
And the
question?
second question, what do you
What
think?
do I
What
make of
is
the
your
guy?
take on Lukashenko? You met him. You
It's.
yourself wrote in the Time magazine story that it wasn't your idea to interview Lukashenko, that somehow Lukashenko people came either to you or to Time magazine, and they expressed their desire that you personally come to Minsk. And you were not arrested, I'm surprised, but anyway, you too, why did, first of all, what is your take on Lukashenko? Secondly, why did they approach you? And thirdly, why you were not afraid to find yourself at the position of our friends who were arrested in Russia?
Well, I'll take that last part later, but let me take the other two questions together. What I made of Lukashenko and how that evolved and how they reached out to me. So in May of this year, I was contacted by an American businessman who's worked for a long time in Belarus. I know him unrelated to his work in Belarus, let's put it that way. And he contacted me, said, I want to talk. It's urgent. He said, when we got on the phone, he said, I want to help you organize an interview with Lukashenko. I was like, what? Okay. I'd never been to Belarus. I'd written a little bit about it, mostly in relation to the popular uprising in 2020 and the crackdown that resulted and so on. But I wouldn't consider myself an expert in that country in particular. And I didn't take this initial approach very seriously. I said, okay, sure. Well, go for it. Let's see. My initial understanding, and this gets to the second question, about what I make of Lukashenko. My initial guess as to why they were reaching out to me was that maybe Lukashenko was getting uncomfortable with his dependence on Russia and was again trying to open up channels to the West, including through the media, including through media interviews. He has done this repeatedly over his 30 plus years in power, shifting between the West and Russia, trying to gain favor and benefits from both sides, and playing both sides often against each other. So it looked to me, my guess was that he was trying to do that again. I saw this in the context of various situations that had happened, in the year before, where Russia had not been a good ally to its vassal states. So, examples, Syria. The Russian regime defended Syria through horrific bombing of civilian populations and opposition forces in Syria from 2015 until 2020, at least. Then, when the war in Ukraine started, that aid or that assistance to Syria began to wither away. And when the regime of Bashar al-Assad in December of 2024 came under direct threat from opposition forces, Russia did not come to his aid. It only offered him a retirement in Moscow and an evacuation flight. Okay, so another example: Armenia. Armenia is a treaty ally of Russia. It had a war with Azerbaijan that it lost completely and very swiftly to Azerbaijan, an ally of Turkey. Russia was under the treaty of mutual defense treaty that Armenia has with Russia. Russia was obligated to come to Armenia's defense somehow to do something. And Armenia was indeed pleading with Russia to help in the war against Azerbaijan. Again, Putin was so preoccupied and tied down with Ukraine that he did nothing. And Armenia, as a result, has suspended its participation in this mutual defense pact. Because it was, quite reasonably outraged that its big brother did not come help. So in that context, I was thinking about why would Lukashenko reach out to me now? I thought maybe he sees that Russia doesn't really help its friends when they need it, and maybe he's, that would inspire him to begin trying to open these channels again to the West, ease sanctions, and turn away from Russia. That was wrong. That my initial guess was incorrect. At that time, I didn't understand anything about the back channel with Trump, anything. This was all totally unknown and unclear to me. Only when I began, taking seriously this idea of going to Belarus and interviewing Lukashenko, I began talking to European diplomats and American diplomats who had been engaging pretty quietly, but still visibly with Lukashenko. So I began calling them, including John Cole, this former lawyer of Trump that I mentioned earlier, various European diplomats who had been making visits to Minsk, and only through those conversations I began to understand what was really going on, that Lukashenko was not in a position to turn away from Russia. He wasn't. He was too dependent. That Russia has such a tight hold over his economy and his military and his everything, that he doesn't have the option of doing what Armenia did and trying to back away. So clearly, he was playing some different game, I learned from talking to the other to the diplomats who engaged with Belarus from the West. And also, so getting to your third question that you asked about the risks. So I am banned from Russia. I've been banned since 2015 because of my journalism.
Because of his big feature story, Crime Without Punishment. I remember it's very
Yeah,
vividly, right?
maybe I don't know.
Yeah.
They never the Russian government never gave a clear
Okay.
answer. Or to my question of why am I banned? They tend not to explain such decisions. But anyway, I'm banned and very much unwelcome in Russia. So I did have concerns about visiting Belarus, which is basically an appendage of Russia for all intents and purposes. So they also have this kind of almost like the Schengen zone, where the border isn't really a border. So that there's no customs between the two. And anyway, so that has implications if Russia has an arrest warrant for me that I am not aware of, but it exists somewhere in the files of the FSB. Would Belarus act on that warrant and arrest me and send me to
And
Russia.
you'll
That,
join Gershkovich in
yeah,
Lipovka,
at
yeah.
that time, yeah, at that time he was still in jail. So I didn't want that to happen. So there were a lot of conversations again with well, Lukashenko's team. I should go back for a second and fill in some detail here. So after that initial outreach from the businessman, he did then put me in touch with a member of a government official in Zelensky's excuse me Lukashenko's administration. Lukashenko's administration. So it became clear that this was serious. Like this was not just some guy messaging me out of the blue. So I began having talks with them and with the European and American diplomats. How safe is it for me to go there? What kinds of security guarantees should I request and can I get as a visiting journalist that they will not arrest me? Of course, the Lukashenko team was saying, no, you're most welcome here. We're inviting you. You're a guest of the president. Nothing will happen. And basically, the Americans and the Europeans told me the same thing. Like you know, if they're inviting you and you know, giving you a visa and setting all this up and reaching out to you, there, this is not probably not a trap. Moreover, the Western diplomats said, if they arrest you, it would negate all of the back channel building that they, the Belarusians, have been working very hard to do in the previous months. So all this outreach to the Europeans, to the Americans, if they arrest an American journalist, like all those channels close, and the sanctions, I guess, probably I would hope would then be doubled or you know more intensified. So all of those people that I consulted with said, Simon, you'll be fine. Don't worry about it. Still, you know, nerve-wracking. But I decided with my editors, of course, that it's worth a try.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I took all three of the questions. I hope.
But you know, so you came to Minsk, you were brought to the interview was in his office, correct?
Yeah, in the palace. Yeah.
In the palace, right?
Yeah, it's
Yeah.
really crazy, crazy building. Very like Borat style, like just straight out of central casting dictator stuff. Like he built this thing. It was opened, I think, in 2013. Enormous, gaudy gold marble building, empty. Like it's, I don't know what it's used for. You saw it was in that the clip he played was in that building. So yeah, I guess once in a while he invites some journalists and does it. But this thing is just enormous, like you know, bigger than a soccer field, and it's covered in portraits of the dictator and various, you know, like as a child and as the head of a collective farm in the Soviet Union and him meeting with, you know, whatever Bill Clinton and the Pope and so on. And I'm like, oh my God, Fidel Castro, and it's just like a shrine, really. It was it really tells you something about the personality and the nature of the regime, the kind of cult of personality and the personalized power that he enjoys there, that he ha even has such a place and builds it for himself. I mean, it's the kind
Was he friendly?
of he seemed a little nervous. Seemed a little nervous. He
Did you
was,
speak Russian?
yeah, he spoke Russian. I had heard from the American diplomats that had visited him. By then, there had been at least three, I think, delegations that had come from Washington to work this back channel with Lukashenko. They had warned me to if, on the day that you're meeting Lukashenko, don't plan anything else because it could go for many hours. Maybe eat something before you go because there may be vodka and there may be a lot of drinking. And you know, prepare for. And actually, the aides to Lukashenko also warned me about this, that Simon, there will be the official interview, but there may be, if the boss is so inclined, a second kind of informal part, which would be whatever, a meal or some kind, you know, back go you go back to his house, you go to a restaurant, something like that. So they were warning me about this. That would be friendly, right? So that's
Right.
he decided not to do that with me.
And he
He
didn't suggest you any vodka in Belarus? No.
no, we did not drink
I
any. We
cannot
did not
believe it.
drink
You know,
any
it's so
vodka.
unhospitable.
There are teacups there. I did not drink my tea.
You understand that that's a reference to the teapot that was used to
I don't know.
poison to poison Litvinenko in London, you know, the Soviet
This is your
Union.
interpretation.
Yeah, no,
Okay.
that's mine.
Yeah, so this to your question, I'm sorry for the long answer to a simple question, but I don't think he was trying to be particularly friendly. He didn't give me the whole song and dance with the lunch and the vodka and all this stuff and the toast that as he had done to for and with the American diplomats. Yeah. He kept it formal. It was quite formal. There was a very long interview. I remember more than 2 hours, with the cameras rolling and everything. And then there was a much shorter off the record or on background discussion that he asked to some things he wanted to tell me on background, so not for the cameras.
And
But
what
that's
was that?
I don't want to, still,
The quote, but just just
there's nothing earth-shattering. But I want to, this is a public discussion, so a journalist's word to keep something on background is important. So I won't talk about that. But anyway, it wasn't that interesting. The what he said publicly on camera, was that was the main message. It was all about the back channel, Trump, Putin, Ukraine, Zelensky. I mean, the thing was incredibly exhaustingly long, this conversation, very
My understanding that Americans asked Lukashenko in exchange for being, this mediator with Putin to release political prisoners. And, many of you know that, the Belarusian dictatorship was very, very harsh. It used to be, before the whole scale invasion in Ukraine, Russia was much more liberal place compared to that of Belarus. And in Belarus, the people, the way, people tortured in the Belarusian prisons, from what we know, it's really so awful. Sergei Tikhanovsky, the husband of Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, the leader of the Russian, or for the Belarusian cabinet and the Belarusian opposition in exile, he spent 5 years, I believe, in a solitary confinement. He didn't have anyone to talk to. He was deprived from normal clothing, from normal food, but also from anything, like it happened with Alexei Navalny in the Russian jail. So as I understand that there was some sort of a deal, because the White House explanation for Trump's praising Lukashenko was that he praised Lukashenko for releasing political prisoners.
The role of political prisoners, I don't mean to cut you off, but yeah, is a fascinating part of how this back channel worked.
So that was, it was, he promised Americans to release XYZ number or what? What was the discussion about?
It was a bit more complicated than that. The political prisoners, as I learned from reporting on how this back channel worked, were a kind of currency. So Lukashenko again has, according to human rights organizations that focus on Belarus, more than 1,000 political prisoners, many of them rounded up again during this failed revolution in 2020. And when this Chris Smith from the State Department began opening this back channel, every time that the Americans, I don't want to say every time, but almost every time that the Americans and Lukashenko's regime had direct contact, Lukashenko would give them a pack of political prisoners to take home, like a gift. And the Americans were asking for
Like
this
slaves,
to
it's a fee.
demonstrate, yeah. But the way that they were used and traded was quite cynical and fascinating from a kind of an analytical perspective of how these prisoners are used. We saw this again, side note, but you mentioned Evan Gershkovich. The swap there, we could spend hours talking about how that unfolded and the various trades that were proposed and what Putin wanted. The trade in human beings has become a part of our geopolitical reality that is really terrifying. And there's a great book called Swap, written by a couple of my colleagues from the Wall Street Journal, published this year that goes into that swap, but also just the phenomenon of this kind of human trade in prisoners, and taking prisoners in order to have them as basically bargaining chips in negotiations. So this was very much the case. So this is a broader phenomenon than Belarus, but Lukashenko was also doing this. So the Americans were also asking for it. They would say, as a trust building measure, or show us that you're serious, release some political prisoners. And thank God. I mean, that's great. The more you can release, the better. And I really commend, and I've specifically, called John Cole at the White House to, commend him for releasing so many people through this back channel. I think that's very much a positive thing that came out of this whole story. But Lukashenko would give, two or three or a dozen at various points in this back in the construction of this back channel to show that he was serious and to keep the Americans talking, to keep them interested.
I see. There is, Maria Kolesnikova. I don't know, how many of you are aware about Maria Kolesnikova. She was one of the leaders of this popular uprising back in 2020 during, when, Lukashenko lost elections and then stole those elections from Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. At least, that's according to the Russian journalists who are now in exile, and all kind of human rights group, including Vesna Spring. It's the human rights organization that monitors the political prisoners in Belarus. So Колесников, they tried the Belarusian KGB, and it still it has this business name KGB. Tried to deport Kolesnikova. She cut in pieces her Belarusian passport at the border, or German even passport at the border, because she has dual citizenship. She's a professional musician, but also she became extremely popular in Belarus. She's a beautiful woman, and anyway, and very very good communicator. So anyway, she already, she has been imprisoned for more than 5 years. She had прободная язва, and I have no idea what's the English for that. I'm sorry, I forgot the dictionary. Anyway, she ended up in the, she was operated in prison. She ended up in the ER, and the Belarusian, I was in Belarus many, many times, so, and I know a thing or two about, the state of medicine in Belarus, and it's awful. So anyway, and still, I understand that many politicians, European politicians, they were asking to try to get Maria Kolesnikova out, but he refuses to, has refused to do it.
I would say, I mean, I haven't seen the lists, but my understanding is that Maria Kolesnikova is at the top of the lists that the Europeans and the Americans, request for release. I asked Lukashenko about Kolesnikova by name, both during the public part of the conversation and during the brief off-record conversation. Lukashenko was a little bit irritated by the kind of her name being brought up so insistently, and said, "Yeah, we'll see." Basically, he said, "We'll see how the conversations with the Americans go. Maybe, anything's possible. Maybe we'll release her." But was quite dismissive. But he did release Sergei Tikhanovsky, who you mentioned earlier. He was also, like Kolesnikova, he was imprisoned in 2020, because both of them were leaders of the uprising in 2020. Sergei Tikhanovsky was actually a presidential candidate very briefly before he was arrested, but he did run for
And a
president.
famous blogger.
He was a famous YouTube influencer and so on. So anyway, he was also very, very, very high on the list of the political prisoners that were that the West was asking to free, and he was freed when the most senior delegation from the Trump administration went to see Lukashenko, as this back channel was really kind of Peking and the discussions of the Alaska summit. They didn't yet know that it would be in Alaska, but this kind of a presidential summit between Putin and Trump was really kind of taking shape. Keith Kellogg, General Kellogg, who I mentioned earlier, an envoy of Trump, went to Minsk, met Lukashenko, did the whole vodka lunch thing, and then as they were driving out, it was impossible to fly because the sanctions have made it basically no airlines fly there. And this is kind of weird side note, I also had to, I took the bus
From
from Vilnius,
ah,
Lithuania. Anyway, so it's very difficult to travel there. So the American delegation with Keith Kellogg and other Chris Smith, the State Department guy, and so on, they were driving from Minsk back west toward Lithuania, and they pulled over in a side road, basically a dirt road, and a van driven by the KGB stopped near them, and the door swung open. And this was scene was described to me by John Cole, the Trump former lawyer. He said, there were these guys, like about a dozen guys with masks and sitting with their heads between their knees, prisoners. They didn't know where they were or what was happening to them. And John Cole recalls, yelling, I'm here to free you. President Trump sent me to set you free. And slowly these prisoners sort of looked up and looked around and began to realize that this was serious. And among them was Sergei Tikhanovsky. So that was a surprise to the Americans. They had not requested Tikhanovsky be freed, as I understand, just because they thought there's no way Lukashenko would let him go because he's so high profile. He was, a presidential candidate, ran against Lukashenko. That's definitely an enemy of the regime. But Lukashenko said, you can have him. And my understanding is he did that to demonstrate again that we in Belarus are very serious about this renewed dialogue with the Americans. And here I'll even give you one of my most valuable bargaining chips. And Sergei Tikhanovsky, I met him in New York earlier this year when he was here for the UN General Assembly events around the UNGA. So he's out and doing well and video blogging again and campaigning for the release of other political prisoners. But yeah.
And creating a little bit of problems for his wife. But anyway, one last question about, on Belarus. Just recently, Mr. Witkoff, the envoy to Russia and Ukraine, whatever, to Russia,
Russia, no.
to Russia, and Jared Kushner, the Donald Trump's son-in-law, they went to see Putin in Moscow.
Yeah.
Putin made them to wait for 3 hours.
Yes.
So, of course, as always, Putin does this on purpose. Tell me, what was it like with Lukashenko?
Yeah, it's funny about that. There's a paragraph, probably the paragraph in my article about all this for Time magazine that got the most attention was described this. So Putin has this habit of being late. And people who study the Russian regime, like Evgenia Markovna and myself, often we get into the habit of how long did Putin make his guest wait? Because you can sort of tell how Putin, what Putin really thinks of that person. So, and you can sort of map this, the Pope, Queen Elizabeth, Bill Clinton, John Kerry when he was Secretary of State, and so on. They're like.
Merkel.
Miracle, right? John Kerry was like 4 hours. Like, wait, Kremlin. So clearly, he's like, you are a scum. I think Queen Elizabeth was only 15 minutes she had to wait. So, like, respect, right? So she wins that contest. And so now, Jared Kushner and Witkoff, 3 hours for Putin. That's a long time. That's a long wait. That is disrespectful. I mean, in any situation, that's disrespectful. But but in Putin's kind of language of tardiness, that is a long time for him to make someone wait. Pope Francis, I believe, was 45 minutes. So, like, we're cool. We're cool. Yeah. So anyway, right. And I described it that Lukashenko, just it's like a funny line from the story. He was early to our, he came early to our interview. Just and just to indicate, I think, or various things about the experience indicated this, that he really wanted this. They reached out to me. They really wanted this interview to push their the agenda for the Anchorage summit, to keep this back channel going, to keep it alive, to keep it effective. So yeah,
Thank you.
that's the lateness thing. But you can, yeah, you can if you go back to. You'll find in the archives of many newspapers kind of reports about how long Putin keeps this or that official waiting.
Kyiv. You have been to Kyiv many times after the Russian whole-scale invasion of Ukraine, and you have had direct access to its courageous president, Volodymyr Zelensky. The latter is under fire now. It is the first time since February 2022 that an anti-Zelensky movement has been formed in Ukraine. What is your take on Zelensky and the current situation?
That is a big question. I wrote a whole book about my take on
Okay, I
Zelensky, but
understand. No, please, just a paragraph.
the current situation. I'll take just the current situation. So yeah, there is a massive investigation that has been going on now for close to 2 years, certainly a year and a half at least. That is run by primarily this agency called NABU, the National Anti-Corruption Bureau of Ukraine. It's an independent law enforcement body created after the revolution in Ukraine in 2014 at the insistence of and under pressure from the West, so European partners and the United States encouraged Ukraine to set up these agencies to try to defeat the monster of corruption that was quite a big problem for Ukraine throughout its history as an independent state. And these agencies were set up again 2014, and they've continued to function. They've always had quite a contentious relationship, as you can imagine, with whatever administration is in power, whether it's Poroshenko, who's Zelensky's predecessor, and indeed with President Zelensky. They do their job. They investigate corruption, and they are independent, and they have support from the West, the US. If they come under attack or political pressure, Western governments generally come to their defense, either publicly or through, more quiet diplomacy with Zelensky and tell him, or again with President Poroshenko before, these institutions need to exist if you want us in the West to continue supporting Ukraine. If you destroy these institutions that provide some checks and balances against corruption, we're done with you, basically. I mean, the message is often delivered in that kind of that level of ultimatum. So anyway, this agency and its partner agencies, I won't give you too many of the acronyms, but anyway, there are a few of these institutions that investigate corruption. And prosecute cases of high-level corruption and so on. They have been working on this investigation into co corruption in various sectors of the economy, the wartime economy now. And they began last month to release some of their findings in quite dramatic fashion with videos that they release where one of the investigators explains the case. And they share actually surveillance recordings that are there's evidence in their case that they're going to bring in court. So it's quite a dramatic presentation of the case, something that would be quite hard to imagine in the US. And the agencies have faced some criticism for just how publicly they have, gone about their investigation. And yeah, so anyway, I'm just for people who may not be totally familiar with this, I'm just giving kind of the background here. So when was that? At the end of November, the investigators came to the home of Zelensky's closest aide and chief of staff, Andrei Yermak, searched his house. And that day, it was actually, what was it? Thanksgiving, right? Yeah, 27th. I don't think it was related to Thanksgiving. But
Right.
anyway, by coincidence. And then that day, Zelensky demanded his resignation, so he resigned. So anyway, this investigation is now really has reached the heart of the Zelensky administration. From what my sources tell me about it, it is far from over. There's still more kind of lines of investigation that will be uncovered. More officials will come under suspicion. More charges will be filed, and so on and so forth. So this has really put a gun to Zelensky's head, in a way that he's never had before. Before the start of the full-scale war or during the full-scale war, he's never faced such pressure from these anti-corruption authorities.
Excuse me, especially given that he ran an anti-corruption ticket in 2019, and he promised because there is abysmal corruption in Ukraine. Of course, in Russia, much worse. It goes without saying. But at that time, Ukraine, in Transparency International Index, if you have Denmark as the cleanest government in the world, it's number one, health position number one. At that time, Ukraine was 124th, on the 124th place, and now it's 104th, 104th place. So they still, Ukraine made some progress under Zelensky. But now we're talking about, the case of embezzlement of $100 million and the kickbacks at the amount of 15% according to New York Times investigation. Sorry for interrupting you.
Yeah, and according to the investigative, the law enforcement
Yes.
bodies. So anyway, so that's kind of the background. So my take on all this. So I have written about corruption cases during the war, previous ones, so not related to this. There have been sort of less high profile cases, but still quite dramatic, related to allegations of corruption in Zelensky's administration during the war years. And I've talked to Zelensky about this and his, the specific cases, but also just his general view of corruption and the agencies that investigate it. To kind of summarize his perspective that he, expressed in in a couple of our conversations, sort of summarizing, he says first that yes, he came to office. One of his main promises. I'd say there were two promises, really, to end the war or prevent a full-scale war with Russia, to basically, make peace with Russia. That was not successful. And the second one was to fight corruption. That was really key to his political project and campaign in 2019 when he ran for president. And he says, I stand by that. That is still my commitment to the Ukrainian people, and that is a top priority for me. And fighting corruption is extremely important. But he tends to ask for a bit of slack from the American and European institutions and governments because he's fighting a war, an existential war for the survival of the country. He says, fighting corruption is a very complicated matter. It's like opening up another front to the war, waging two wars at the same time. So he tends to punt a little bit and say, yes, corruption is extremely important to fight, but I'm a little bit busy here with the whole invasion thing. Like, can you please, give me some slack? And then, also in our conversations, we've talked about my conversations with him and also his advisors, how difficult it is. Well, first of all, how important it is at a time of war to have and again, I'm not giving you my opinion. I'm summarizing the Zelensky. So my understanding of the Zelensky administration's point of view here. So I want to separate myself from this. How important it is at a time of war to have a united, strong team leading the country, a strong administration. Now, when you have anti-corruption investigators coming in, interrogating people, encouraging people to, for lack of a better word, snitch on each other. Or, give information about each other to investigators about, oh, he's, I don't know, he might be a little, lining his pockets and so on. This creates disunity in the administration, and it disturbs their work. So they tend to kind of plead for a little bit of understanding, even though they say again and again that corruption needs to be rooted out, but they also complain about how disruptive and distracting it is when you have anti-corruption investigators breathing down the neck of the investigation in the middle of a war. So it causes all kinds of infighting within the team. It often puts pressure on Zelensky to fire very senior people who have not been convicted and found guilty of corruption, but are perhaps under suspicion or have been accused. As soon as someone in his he often complains about this. As soon as someone is accused of wrongdoing, there's pressure on Zelensky to fire him. And I know very senior administration officials in the Biden administration, the U.S. government, told Zelensky to, this guy's under suspicion, you need to fire him. Like going all the way up to the former defense minister. So Zelensky doesn't like that because it's like, well, come on, let's at least let the court process work here. I can't just have an accusation lead to the firing of the whole defense ministry leadership in the middle of a war. Like, you guys are crazy. I then need what? I need to then find new people to lead the defense ministry. That's an important ministry in the middle of a war. So you get it. I'm sort of mimicking a little bit the tone and the messaging of President Zelensky when I've had these conversations with him. I'm not quoting him verbatim, but I'm sort of giving you a sense of the in between. Insisting on and pledging to fight corruption, the points he tries to make. And I do, again, like putting on my own kind of human journalist hat again, I do sympathize. I have seen, again, from spending a lot of time within the offices of the president there in Kyiv, how there is infighting. There are clans, there are teams that hate each other. In the very first days of the full-scale war, all those rivalries evaporated and everyone was working side by side. The feeling of danger really united people, the common cause. But within a few months of that full-scale invasion, the infighting returned and people began again jockeying for position. And part of that, I did see people would come to me as a journalist and say, like, "Hey, Simon, that guy's corrupt." What makes you say that? And they wouldn't really give any evidence. But this kind of thing does happen. It's kind of innuendo, attempts to use accusations to sideline your rival within the administration. This is not unique to Ukraine. I think this is quite common in any power structure, where there are clans, there are different centers, there are different people, there are rivalries, between people who want to have authority over some part of the government function. And they're trying to sideline their rivals and so on. So, it's messy. And Zelensky's job is to try to keep this giant machine working properly. So again, not to hammer on this point too much, but he does ask for some patience when I've spoken to him about this, and saying, we're going to deal with these problems, but like, please don't. I can't fire everyone because then I'll just be here alone trying to fight this war. Anyway, sorry, long answer, but I wanted to give you a sense of kind of summarizing a whole bunch of different conversations with him and his team members, how they tend to see this, see the pressure of the anti-corruption authorities bearing down on them and what they how they talk about it amongst themselves.
When the whole-scale invasion started, a lot of money and taxpayers' money, both American and European, they went into Ukraine. Basically, now Europe predominantly covers the budget of that of Ukraine. And as far as I understand, there was, that's why both Americans and Europeans insisted on creating supervisory boards that allowed independent experts, typically from other countries, to scrutinize major decisions within Ukrainian state-owned companies. So, according to the latest New York Times investigation, Zelensky people basically took control of some of those supervisory boards. Quote from the New York Times: "In documents and interviews with about 20 Western and Ukrainian officials who have worked closely with company boards or served on them, the Times found political interference not only at Energoatom, and Energoatom at the heart of this corruption scandal, but also at the state-owned electricity company, Ukrenergo, as well as Ukrainian Defense Procurement Agency, end of quote. I just yesterday, I had a show on my YouTube channel with somebody who resides in Kyiv. And I was asking what's the situation with the heat and, because it's winter, it's cold. So in Kyiv now, they have electricity 8 hours a day. And meaning, if you don't have electricity, you don't have hot water, you don't have real heat, et cetera. Only, in those apartment buildings that there is a gas supply, then, people have such. The similar situation in Kharkiv, in Odessa, and given that Putin time and again, bombs and destroys, this precisely this this energy infrastructure. It's especially appalling to read that all these kickbacks were made first and foremost from selling services to service different energy. Atomic energy, stations, IS. So my question, in your book and in the piece that was published in Time Magazine, I believe, probably 2 years ago, you quoted one of the officials of the presidential administration who said that, quote, they were stealing as if the end of the world were tomorrow.
Yeah, they're stealing like there's no tomorrow.
As they're known tomorrow, I'm sorry. Yes. So, my question, you say that Zelensky, I understand this notion that, yes, you need a team, et cetera. But, it apparently turned out that one of the closest friends of that of Zelensky created what, investigators call a criminal organization, Miniture.
Miniature, huh?
Yes, right? He was Zelensky's partner in Kvartal 95, in his TV company. Now, Yermak is fired. Yes, I mean there was they searched his apartment, not office, but his apartment. And Yermak announced that he's going to go to the front lines as a soldier. And somebody with whom I spoke in Kyiv said that probably he will do this because it's a good political PR move. Now. But obviously, there is Umerov who now, is in charge of negotiations with Americans. He's also under fire because people in Kyiv say that he's the next. So anyway, it's obvious, and for those of you who don't know about the scandal, Nabu managed to tape. I don't know, on which basis, how legal all was taping happened, but anyway, Nabu managed to tape hell of a lot of bureaucrats, chinovniki, in Ukraine, and they spoke to each other under pseudonyms, and they were all kind of, very funny nicknames, that were used, and now they're deciphering, all this, Anyway, but it's clear that, a lot of people were involved, and it couldn't go like that for years unless there was, protection from the very top of the Ukrainian government. So once again, do and just I believe today, I believe Trump says, so it's time for presidential elections in Ukraine. So political journalist Dasha Burns asked the US president whether Ukraine should hold elections. Quote, yeah, I think so. It's been a long time. Things aren't going very well. Yeah, I think it's time. They're using war not to hold an election, but I would think the Ukrainian people should have that choice. And maybe Zelensky would win, but they haven't had an election in a long time. They talk about democracy, but it gets to a point where it is not democracy anymore, Donald Trump said. End of quote. So my question to you, do you expect Zelensky to go for elections? Is it time for elections, Ukraine? Is it possible to conduct elections given that 12 million Ukrainians are outside the country and a couple of millions are on the front lines? And people are spread all around the country and nobody knows where. So what do you think?
Yeah, I should say that just when I was on the way here, there was I got a message from my editor with news that I haven't looked at it, that Zelensky said that he is ready to have elections.
Yeah, but it's not the first time that Zelensky said, you
Yeah,
know.
but anyway, the headline my editor sent me said that there's like now a time frame. Anyway, so we should check the latest news.
I'm
Anyways,
sorry.
yeah, but so this is a developing story. But yeah, but broadly, I've talked to Zelensky about his kind of views on holding elections in wartime. He is against it. He's against it. I'd say that there are members of his team. There's a kind of interesting debate that plays out among his advisors and members of the administration, where over the course of the full-scale war, they've debated, okay, maybe now is a good time to just have elections. This is usually at a time when Zelensky's popularity is high, and members of his administration point out that, hey, boss, if we have elections now, we can lock it. You'd win. There are no competitors who are nearly as popular, and you'd lock in another 5-year term, and we get rid of all of these questions like Donald Trump raised today. These have been raised before many times about legitimacy. So Zelensky's term officially ran out
2023.
24, yeah, 24. I think the spring of 24. The elections were scheduled in 24.
60 to 90 days.
Yeah, 60, 90 days. That's the headline I saw, right? So
He's
Zelensky ready to hold elections if partners ensure security.
but peace that
That's quite an
security for the
if.
world must be guaranteed.
Yeah, that phrase about if partners ensure security is doing a lot of work there. Anyway, thank you, Sveta. So this debate has played out periodically during the war. So I mean, so since the his term ran out in the April, I believe it was April 2024, was when Ukraine should have had elections if it weren't for martial law. And his advisors, argue for this. There's actually a point earlier this year after the famous fight in the Oval Office between Trump, Vance on one side, Zelensky on the other. You all saw this video. Zelensky's popularity in Ukraine shot up like crazy after that. I mean, he gained 10, 15, 10 to 15 percentage points in the polls. Because of the way he behaved in the Oval Office, he was seen in Ukraine, broadly speaking, as having, held his own, done his country proud, in his behavior. The way he didn't let himself get kicked around there. So th there were people in his entourage who said, like, that looks like a good time to have some elections. His answer consistently, and I've heard this indirectly through advisors, and I've talked to him directly about this question, is no, no way. You cannot have elections during a war. And he gives a couple reasons. I'll just lay them out briefly. I had a long conversation with him about this, but very briefly. Number one, martial law. The text of martial law prohibits elections. It is illegal to have elections during martial law, so during a war.
Rather, it's illegal to have elections for the
Presidential coup?
Ukrainian. No, there should have been decision made by the Supreme Court of Ukraine, and there was only the decision made by the Parliament of Ukraine, and that's the problem. That there was there are no there have been no legal grounds not to conduct elections in 2020. Precisely because there were no there have been no decision by the Supreme Court of Ukraine.
Yeah, we should look this up. My understanding of the wording of martial law is that national elections
Only
are
Rada,
not
because
pro
Ukraine's when Ukraine went and the full-scale invasion started, Ukraine was in the process of transitioning from the presidential republic into parliamentary republic. That's why there was in the law there is it's with respect to Rada, not the presidency. So anyway.
Well, President Zelensky clearly feels that a presidential election would not be allowed under martial law. I'll leave it to the
But
lawyers.
Lincoln had elections even this
That's
week.
right, yeah. Yeah,
What do you think?
and Winston Churchill lost elections shortly after World War II. So anyway, it could go either way. Yeah, so he says, illegal to have elections. I don't won't take a position on what the law says, but he believes it is illegal. So he would have to lift martial law in order to hold elections, hold presidential elections or parliamentary elections. When you lift martial law, that means that men of fighting age, now what is it, from 25 to 60, are no longer restricted from leaving the country. You would have, I mean, there would be all kinds of ripple effects to lifting martial law, but one of them is anyone who is afraid of the draft, and there are many, would leave the country. That is, not good if you are not done fighting that war. And the other thing that he talks about, in this context is just how, the thing that has allowed Ukraine to survive the war, he says, is first and foremost unity, the unity of the people, and their coming together to fend off this foreign aggression, this genocidal aggression against Ukraine. And he argues that if you shift from a state of war to a presidential election campaign or a parliamentary election campaign, you could forget about unity. So that activates all of the many competing political forces, political parties. They begin to campaign against each other. They begin fighting each other for power, and that is antithetical and thoroughly destructive to the unity of the nation, which is of utmost importance, Zelensky says, at a time of war. So, and then the third point, I'll stop, is security. So so say you have election day, and Russia sends up two of its fighter jets with ballistic missiles on them. Normally, that means there's a nationwide alert, and everybody needs to go to a shelter. How do you vote if that happens, right? So there are these kind of technical questions related to security. There's the question of people who Ukrainian citizens who are living in occupied territories. There are millions of them, a few million. I don't remember the numbers exactly. They would, of course, not be allowed to vote. You're not going to have elections in the occupied territories. So it also, you get into all kinds of kind of legal ramifications where also he argues that if you hold elections, then you leave those people out, you're legitimizing the occupation because you're saying that, okay, these parts of Ukraine are voting for a parliament, but those other parts,
Yeah, that's a good point.
you're sort of giving them up. You're not allowing them to participate in Ukraine, and that also defeats or undermines the message that no, we want all those people back. We want all those territories back. Anyway, I could go on, and he does go on at length on these various things. It's easy to say, bro, have elections. You should have had elections 2 years ago. What's wrong with you? But he always says, let's think about what that means and what that looks like in practice. And when you hear him and some of his advisors kind of explain this, it is quite problematic. But they are very sensitive to these questions of legitimacy. He hates getting this question, but he presents a lot of arguments that I think deserve to be considered and taken seriously as to why elections are quite difficult to hold at a time of all-out war.
What do you think, does Zelensky have a chance to win elections given that one, according to some sources in Kyiv, his ratings now is around 20-25%. Two, that he had to fire Yermak, and just to give you understanding how important Yermak was for the office and for people for Zelensky, his nickname Alla Borisovna. And people, when people talk about Yermak, in the on WhatsApp, they don't call him Andrei Boris. They call him Alla Borisovna just to point out how, that he's more important than the first lady. So, yeah, I know.
Yeah, or is Andrei Borisovich is his name patronymic, so it's
Yes, of course.
sounds similar.
Right. But my question is, do you think Zelensky can win those elections? Some people say that he's winning in the second round, not in the.
Right, yeah. I mean, that, again, that's the debate I mentioned. Like they, you know, there are all kinds of the administration is big. There are people there who, you know, do what they call closed polling. So polls ordered by, I'm forgetting the commissioned by
Yeah.
the administration that are not for public consumption, but you know, focus groups also. This stuff's going on even more time. So they're getting they're doing their sociology and they're look they're you know I really don't know how much time Zelensky spends looking at these results, but some, you know, he pays attention to what the people are saying. So again, the corruption scandal has caused his popularity to drop precipitously. He has seen over the course of the full scale invasion the popular his standing in the polls really has been volatile to use a term from the stock market. So you want to look at March 2022, 90% support, above 90%, like right after the invasion. And then, you know, and then it slowly declined. And then, you know, 2023, it depends on what's happening in the war. Now this corruption scandal is everyone is talking about it, for good reason. It is, you know, horrifying what the investigators are alleging. So now he would have a much harder time. 60 to 90 days, I think, and I haven't talked to him about this. This is all very fresh breaking news. I expect he would say 90 days is a long time in our, he likes to say this. He's like, you know, often when you sit down with him, he's like, what day is it? Is it Tuesday? When did that thing happen? He's like, it's a week ago. He's like, man, that feels like a year ago. Time is moving so slowly. This is like a rant he goes on. And it's true. I mean, if you ha he's, he, when you have as much to do as he does, time tends to be warped. So coming to the point, I think he could say that 90 days is a long time in politics. If it's really, you know, they plan to have these things in 60 to 90 days, and you could see a situation where it turns around. So I don't know. You also have to look at the possible competitors.
Absolutely.
Zaluzny, right. My book about Zelensky is mostly about Zelensky, I guess, but there are two other characters that are very prominent. One is the First Lady, Olena Zelenska, and the other one is Zaluzny, who was for the first 2.5 years of the full-scale war the top military commander, and has been in that period when he was the top military commander and after he was fired, the main. How to put it? The most popular political figure after Zelensky, they're sort of always a little bit like neck and neck. The last polls I saw before the corruption scandal, Zaluzhny was already ahead
And he
in the press
counted the
polls.
ambassador to London.
Yeah, he's currently the ambassador to London, which makes it even more confusing because like he is, you know, in the hierarchy. Below, anyway, below Zelensky, whatever. But opinion polls, public opinion polls, they do check how would you vote if Zaluzhny and Zelensky were to run against each other, and it's very inconclusive before the corruption scandal. After the corruption scandal, I expect the polls will say Zaluzhny will be quite a bit ahead. Zaluzhny, I've talked to Zaluzhny about the his possibility of him running for office and so on. He's a bit coy about it. He's not he says things like, people are always trying to pull me into politics, meaning he gets visits both when he was commander of the armed forces and in his role as the ambassador to London. He gets visits from various politicians. I won't name them. He did name them. Who say, you know, come join our party and we'll take Zelensky down together. And he says, you know, I don't want to be your show horse for your political campaigns. Like, leave me out of it. But I know that he has considered this. He has thought about it. He's not a political animal. He's this is not a his comfort zone. He's a military man. He has taken steps and made statements that sound potentially like a political platform. Just at the end of November, as the maybe it was already in early December, as the corruption scandal was really gaining steam, I think it was right around the time Yermak was dismissed. Zaluzhny published a couple of opinion pieces, one in the Daily Telegraph in the UK. Again, he's the ambassador to London, so that makes sense. And one in British, excuse me, Ukrainian outlet that's much longer. But then he went quiet. I reached out to him. I was like, "Well, it looks like you have a lot to say. It looks almost like you want to present some kind of political platform." Yeah. He said, "Simon, very nice to hear from you, but like I don't I said my piece and he." So if he was like going whole hog into election mode, I guess he would have wanted to, to talk and give interviews, and but he declined. And so it's not clear to me whether he would go for it, whether he would. There's so many variables. So if he does decide to go for it, does he form his own political party and try to build up a national political machine, in 60 to 90 days? Difficult. Does he join another political party, in which case, which one? And does that hurt him or help him, given how weak most of the other political forces are? So there's all kinds of variables here. If Zelensky goes ahead with this idea to hold elections, it will be a very intense period of jockeying for power. Zaluzhny probably will play some role. There have also been attempts to kind of unite with Zelensky and Zaluzhny to sort of put aside their differences and kind of join forces also in a political sense. Those are kind of open discussions, as I understand, inconclusive. So anyway, this is really getting down into the weeds of
Yeah.
Ukrainian politics. I'm sorry, but yeah, just
Simon, thank you so
long,
much.
long answer.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time, and I really hate not to give you the possibility for the audience to
Yeah,
ask you
please.
questions. So I have a couple of more questions, but unfortunately, we have to stop here.
We luckily see each other fairly often.
Yes, it's true.
We
It's
can
true. It's
continue. All
true.
right. Yes.
Okay.
But yeah, please.
Yes, Svetlana, please.
So what's happening to the back channel now, just to your knowledge?
Well, the back channel, yeah, thank you. It's a good question. The back channel served its function with the summit in Alaska. And it seems to have that used itself up. That was the purpose. For both sides, I should say, the Americans and the Russians. In this case, Belarus is an instrument of Russia, so yeah, one team and the other team. So after the Alaska summit, it sort of died down. There are still discussions of releasing more political prisoners, for sure, and there are a lot of discussions on Belarus pushing for sanctions relief, and it has gotten some as a kind of repayment. But this was very soon after Alaska. There was the back channel led to an easing of sanctions on the it was a very it's a small thing, but it was very sensitive to both Russia and Belarus, aviation parts. So if you don't have parts for your Airbus planes, they eventually break down, and you can't fly. Like, you literally, as the head of state, your plane doesn't work. That sucks for them. Boo hoo. So the Americans gave some relief to Belarus to be able to buy airplane parts. And it's widely understood that these parts, because there's basically no border between Belarus and Russia, that these parts will go to Russia and fix up Putin's Air Force One as well. So that was a kind of a very welcome result for Belarus of these negotiations. And I'll say that it was the I was surprised that when we talked about what sanctions relief he wanted, that was the one he mentioned first. Air
Aeroflot
airplanes. Yeah, Belavia, yeah.
Avia.
Belavia, yeah, is the national airline, and their planes were breaking down. So, and that's very sensitive to, also the elites, people who can afford to fly and so on. Like, that's annoying. They need to go to Turkey and Dubai or whatever. They need to go to Moscow on their plane. and they don't have whatever. I don't know anything about airplane engineering, but you get
So
it.
back to Lukashenko, to use one of Putin's precious phrases, I wish him the best of health. But is there a horizon on how long before he enters his twilight years? And are there any names talked about as a possible successor?
Lukashenko.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, Kolya, yes. So,
His grandson.
his son, no,
Oh, his son, I'm
his
sorry.
youngest son. Yeah, he has three sons, but it's also it's weird. So there's this kid Kolya. He's now 20 years old. Last I checked, maybe turned 21. Anyway, somewhere around there. And since he was basically like 5 or 6. His father has been taking him along on all these trips. Like he's met Obama, he met the Pope, he met Xi Jinping. Like he takes this kid everywhere, clearly grooming him for power. And then, so when I was discussing this interview with Lukashenko, his team began kind of suggesting, Simon, while you're here, maybe you'll want to talk to some other people, maybe like maybe one of the president's sons. I was like, yeah, okay, sure, well, that sounds interesting. And then they eventually settled on that son. So they're two older sons from a different mother. But they sort of arranged for me to meet with the younger son, Kolya. And Lukashenko, during our interview, was encouraging this. So he wanted me to speak with his youngest son. Again, I saw this in the context of the grooming for power that has been going on for as long as this young man has been alive. And I was very curious to meet him also as a kind of just as a character study, and what does that do to a person to be at the center of near absolute power and to be groomed for it through the years. And it was fascinating. I talked to him for a couple of hours. It was clear to me that yes, he is being prepared for power. It's not clear when. Lukashenko hinted during our interview that he didn't say it very clearly, but it was up for interpretation. But he hinted that maybe he won't run again in when is the next one? 2030? Anyway, when is next? I don't remember the date, but when his next presidential term runs out, he might step aside. Yeah, so Kolya would be then around 25. We could talk all day about him, but in that case, the succession plan is quite clear. In contrast to Russia, and Yevgeny Markovna can speak about this with a lot more authority than I. But in Putin's case, the succession plan is very vague, and I understand this may be on purpose to not allow a sort of possible successor to. For kind of Kremlin clans to congregate around a possible successor to Putin. Lukashenko, also a dictator, also absolute power, whatever, totalitarian, has taken a very different approach. He has very clearly signaled for many years, more than a decade now, this is my boy. He comes with me to meet everyone. And he usually just stands there quietly, doesn't say much. This was the first time he'd spoken to a Western journalist. He had spoken once before to a Russian state TV channel. But yeah, so anyway,
Did you
we
speak
can
Russian or English?
Russian.
Russian.
Wait, yeah, Russian. But he did say a few phrases in English, and it seemed like his English was pretty good. I don't know. I didn't give him a test.
Yes, please.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that Putin made Steve Witkoff wait 3 hours as a sign of disrespect. That kind of surprises me because, ever since the Bloomberg leak of the transcript between him and the Kremlin official, kind of seems that Steve Witkoff is sympathetic to Russia to some extent, or at least within the Trump administration, he's more pro-Russia than some other people. So why wouldn't Putin like roll out the red carpet for him?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think I was more surprised by Jared Kushner.
Of course, it
As
was all
a,
about Jared Kushner,
yeah,
I
I think
think.
Jared, and also in Putin's kind of worldview, Jared Kushner is a more, he has more authority, the
That
Zets, right? Or what? There's a Zets.
that
Yeah,
Putin.
the son in-law.
Son-in-law.
is a close relation in any society, but the idea of the Zets in Russian has kind of a more anyway, it's a colorful term that has a lot of kind of weight. So in Putin's understanding, first of all, he'd never met Jared before, and this was a family member of the US president. So making him wait 3 hours surprised me. Witkoff, I think I understood that as like a hierarchy thing. Like, I am the equal of the US president, Putin thinks. Debatable. And so Witkoff is like one of the errand boys for the US president, so he can wait. I can play hockey or whatever while he waits. Jared Kushner was interesting because that is in Putin's worldview, and please correct me, you know this much better than I do. Putin would see that as an insult to Trump, making
Absolutely, 100%.
the son-in-law wait for 3 hours.
It was
That's
a message to Donald.
a message to Donald Trump that,
I think
that
because
was
of
shocking.
sanctions against Russian oil.
Yeah, that's
Yeah,
a good
that was,
explanation. Yeah. And also because they keep, you keep sending your people here with the same requests. They keep asking me to change my position on Ukraine, and I'm not going to do it. I'm tired of giving you all the same lecture about medieval Slavic history. But I will do it if you come here again and again. I will give you the same lecture. And he gave it to Jared.
Of
Um,
course.
but uh, but he's like, another one of these Poslanniki, envoys of Trump. Anyway, but no, I was surprised by that because again, like that in Putin's panyatia or understandings, kind of informal rules of behavior, making a family member wait, your son-in-law
But
is a bit of a middle finger.
as a result of sanctions against Rosneft and Lukoil, and as a result of, that basically India had to stop buying Russian oil despite all this love between Modi and Putin, and major Chinese companies had to stop. Russia lost 70% of its all revenues as of now, and so they have much less money to kill Ukrainians. So yes, please, last question probably.
Fascinating. Thank you. I'm curious, what are your views on Yermak himself? You've seen the man, you've been in his office. What's your sense of who he is? Like, was it he's fully like implicated in corruption? Like, what is
I can't say if he's implicated in corruption. We have to stick to the presumption of innocence, and I'm as interested in you and hearing what the investigators find. They have not yet charged him with anything or even issued a notice of suspicion. They've searched his home, so I can't say what he did or didn't do, what he knew. I guess I can I did spend a lot of I spent while writing the book more time with Yermak than with Zelensky. That's definitely true. And I got to know him well. When you get to know someone, when you spend many hours talking to them and spending time with them, traveling and so on, you sort of see them as a three-dimensional human being. As I was lucky enough to get to know both Zelensky and Yermak and others and their team. So I don't have this caricature in my mind when I think of Yermak. He is demonized. He is so, the people who hate him with a passion. And he has earned a lot of enemies for various reasons. Some deserved, some I think not deserved. I think Zelensky always saw him as a very effective executor of his orders. And Zelensky would underline, and this was also my observations when I saw the way they ran the administration, that Yermak was not a gray cardinal, he was a right-hand man. And there's a subtle but important difference. The gray cardinal has his own agenda that he's, weaving some kind of plots and doing things behind the back of usually the kind of inebriated or aging head of state, right? That's a different picture. They were partners, close friends, and Yermak was just very effective and quite, I'd say, brutal in the way he carried out the president's wishes. And those wishes were often stated kind of not with a direct kind of step-by-step, Andrei, I want you to do this, this, this. Zelensky would say, like, we have this problem, we need to fix it. and Yermak would take it upon himself to fix it. I think the glue of their relationship, their friendship is part of it, and so on, loyalty. But also, it was just that Yermak got it done again and again. And I think, and Zelensky has said this publicly, that Yermak was a very effective functionary in this way, that he carried out the orders of the president and made things happen. I think that also that the nature of that relationship also exposes Zelensky more to the corruption allegations, right? Zelensky has said publicly so many times that this is my right-hand man. If you have a problem, he said this, there's footage, and he said this to me as well when I asked about it. If you have a problem with Yermak, you got a problem with me, basically. So that makes it more difficult for him to distance himself now from Yermak. But he's trying. I think he could succeed. I don't know. I generally, so my kind of picture of Yermak is more like that. He was a very bombastic, efficient, unsparing boss and operator. That earns you enemies, as you can imagine. One last point on this. The way that he earned a lot of his enemies was when you had martial law take effect. One thing that results from martial law is power is concentrated in the executive branch, so that the executive and the president and his team can lead the country through the war. This is sort of written into the legislation. And that weakens the other institutions, the parliament and the government ministries. So because of that, Yermak and Zelensky, basically power concentrated in their hands, and to the great frustration, for example, of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Yermak would effectively function as the foreign minister and many other minister of economy. He would make decisions that in a peacetime would be delegated to the ministries. So that earned him a lot of enemies within those ministries, who were like, we're here, we are seated, we're ready to work, but all the decisions are being made by the office of the president. So, I could understand both sides of that argument. The argument on the president's side was, we're in a war, we need to make decisions fast, effectively. Martial law gives us this authority, and we're going to use that authority as to the full extent that we can legally. The argument on the other side is like, why is the Ministry of Foreign Affairs sitting and twiddling its thumbs while Andrei Yermak is sort of, traveling the world and meeting foreign leaders and foreign diplomats, indeed. So anyway, you see how that could cause tensions there, right? And earn him a lot of enemies. So I saw that going on as well. Anyway, it's a complicated character. But in terms of the corruption allegations, we have to wait for the evidence.
Simon, thank you so much. And unfortunately, we ran out of time. I would like to thank Sasha Spitalnik, Kirill Buskov, and the entire team of, you see, sitting on the coach. So thank you very much for setting up this event and for doing, the dubbing of Lukashenko's speech. Yes, that's Kirill Buskov. Yes, he's a student at the NYU School of Journalism. So thank you very much, and thank you very much to all of you for coming. This will be posted on the Jordan Center YouTube channel. It's also going to be with thanks once again to Kirill Guskov. There will be subs, Russian subs, and will be posted on the New Times Yevgeny Albov channel, so that Russians can, and that's important for me personally, that Russians have access to real experts and real information. And the transcript, edited for length and clarity, will be published on the New Times website, newtimes.ru. Thank you so much, and thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. It was real.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Please subscribe to our social media.
Yeah.
Jordan Center. Thank you.
Yes.
Brilliant.